A Philadelphia judge sentences a veteran political operative to 4 years probation for his role helping former Congressman Shaka Fatah carry out what prosecutors called a white-collar crime spree. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Aaron Mozell reports, the ruling comes as Fatah waits to learn his fate after being convicted on several corruption charges.
Gregory Naylor has helped countless Philadelphia politicians as a behind-the-scenes operative. His specialty, organizing and executing get-out-the-vote efforts on Election Day. In 2007, Naylor was part of Shaka Fatah's bid for Philadelphia mayor. That was the year Michael Nutter won the big office in City Hall. In 2014, Naylor pleaded guilty to helping Fatah conceal the repayment of an illegal $1 million loan made to the campaign years earlier. At sentencing, prosecutors said Naylor should get jail time. U.S. District Judge Harvey Bartle instead handed the 68-year-old 4 years probation and a $10,000 fine. The ruling drew tears and yelps of joy from a jam-packed gallery of supporters. Afterwards, Robert Levant, Naylor's lawyer, said Bartle's decision was right.
The sentence speaks volumes about the way Greg Naylor has lived his life for 68 years, the things he's done in the community, and the fact that none of us are defined by one mistake, but by the way we transition when that mistake is made.
Prosecutors declined comment. Naylor is the first of six defendants to be sentenced in the Fatah case. Fatah, who resigned from office in June after being convicted of corruption, is currently scheduled to learn his fate in early October, though that hearing is expected to be delayed. Fatah's lawyers have filed motions for acquittal and a new trial, and Bartle must rule on those before sentencing. All of this will unfold in the weeks leading up to a pair of elections scheduled for November 8th. That's the date of the general election, but also a special election to fill the vacancy left when Fatah stepped down. Democratic Pennsylvania State Rep Dwight Evans faces Republican James Jones in both races. Given the district's lopsided voter registration rules, Evans will likely win both races. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia region was a popular stopping point for politicians today. U.S. Senator Bob Casey was in North Wales, once again calling on the federal government to study the health effects of water contaminated with chemicals tied to military facilities in Bucks and Montgomery counties. Residents of Horsham, Warrington, and Warminster have expressed health concerns regarding their drinking water, which has been polluted with chemicals believed to have come from the fire-fighting foam used at military facilities. Casey says the contamination is the government's fault, and Washington needs to fix it.
This water was not contaminated before the federal government arrived at these communities years ago. So it's the federal government's responsibility to make sure that this gets corrected.
Casey is asking the Department of Defense, Environmental Protection Agency, and the Centers for Disease Control to test the area's water and determine its subsequent health effects. The Navy declined to pay for health testing of residents, saying those results would not prove where the contamination came from. Republican vice presidential candidate Governor Mike Pence made a couple of local campaign stops today, first in King of Prussia at TechTube, a manufacturing company, and then at a public rally in Pipersville in Upper Bucks County. Governor Pence pushed Donald Trump as the candidate Pennsylvania and the nation needs.
We can come together here in Pennsylvania and all across this country, and we can elect someone who's a leader, who's a fighter, who will bring real change to Washington, D.C.
Pence also made it clear he thinks Trump would be better for the economy.
He will upend the status quo in the nation's capital, and he will get this economy working again for every American in every community.
And the media was another talking point for the governor.
In this battle, it almost feels like it's 2-on-1, doesn't it? I mean, it's like the media is doing half of Hillary Clinton's work for her every day.
Pence also stopped in Norristown for a haircut in between rallies. Governor Chris Christie has been stopping in towns across New Jersey, pushing his new education funding formula. WHYY's Joe Hernandez attended a forum the governor held today in Burlington County.
The welcoming committee in Bordentown was probably not what Christie had in mind. Dozens of protesters lined the sidewalks outside the local firehouse where the forum was about to take place. Naomi Johnson LaFleur is president of the Trenton Education Association. She says Christie's proposal would hurt urban districts like Trenton, which is only about 7 miles away from Bordentown.
90% of our students or live at poverty levels. And for him to say that he's going to cut that funding is to say, I don't care about you.
Right now, many urban New Jersey districts get a larger share of state aid, while the more suburban districts get less. Christie wants to change that, doling out education aid evenly, the same amount for each student, no matter where. This would replace the current need-based formula. He says that will lower property taxes in 75% of districts where school aid would increase.
The biggest problem we'd have then is all the EMS calls that we'd have to be making to people who are passing out in their kitchens when they opened up their property tax bill in New Jersey and saw it less.
But he got pushback during the forum from some members of the public who asked how the plan would benefit the 25% of school districts that would see their funding cut. Christie said it would force low-performing districts to take a look at their methods and figure out how to improve.
If we keep sending the money at the rate that we're sending it now, there is no mechanism which will force them to reevaluate the way they're failing in educating these children. They will continue on the same path. I am trying to force change here. We're forcing change. And
the proposal has yet to get a hearing from the state legislature, which is controlled by Democrats. If enacted, it would upend decades of mandates from the New Jersey Supreme Court and likely result in a legal challenge. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania took a big step forward this year to begin to correct decades of education funding inequities. But much of the disparity that has grown over time is set to be locked in place for many years to come. As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCory reports, a new study looks at that dynamic and finds the school districts most negatively affected serve more students of color.
When David Mazenkis pours through state school funding data, he keeps history front and center in his mind.
We've got a responsibility as a country that has a legacy of severe and overt racism to correct that when we notice it's happening and make sure we don't perpetuate it anymore.
Mazenkis is a data scientist by trade and member of the faith-based advocacy group, Power. In the past few years, he's used his data skills to bolster Power's message on education funding, zeroing in on how some state policies have disproportionately hurt school districts serving many students of color. His most recent study looks at how lawmakers are using the new school funding formula. The formula itself has been widely lauded, as it injects common sense into what had become a haphazard and unscientific system. If the new formula was used to divide the entire pot of state aid, the most money per pupil would go to the schools facing the greatest challenges, which would be a major boon for districts serving many students of color. But that's not the plan. Lawmakers aim to use the formula only to divide new increases in funding. So at this point, that adds up to about 6% of the whole.
What we've said is, now that we understand exactly how racially biased the historical funding has been, let's lock it into place and continue it going forward and only change it in a very minor way with diluting it with a little bit of fair funding.
As is, Mazenkis finds that the districts with the fewest white students are shortchanged, according to the formula, by almost $2,000 per pupil, while the districts with the most white students get about that much more per pupil than what the formula says is their fair share. Power's report finds that even when controlling for poverty, race is a robust indicator of inequity. A Keystone Crossroads analysis finds that this has occurred largely based on a state policy that favors districts with declining student populations. And Mozenkis agrees that current inequities aren't the product of overt racism.
There are a lot of ways that racism manifests itself in our society, and a lot of them are not because individuals are consciously racist or making decisions to consciously underserve or discriminate against people of color.
But correcting this by fully implementing the formula has been a political non-starter, as it would essentially benefit 30% of the school districts in the state by taking funds away from the rest. So Power is pushing for a middle ground, urging the state to set a more aggressive timeline to fix the problem. House Republicans, though, say the group is hurting its argument by framing it around race. Spokesman Steve Miskin says the report's premise is, quote, spin to garner attention.
You know, if you want to have a conversation about distressed districts and distressed schools, we're open to that. But to slap a, you know, racial label doesn't do anybody any good. It just charges a situation that doesn't need it.
Keystone Crossroads reached out to a diverse set of sources for feedback on Mozenkis' report. A spokeswoman for Senate Republicans said they had no opinion about its merits. House Democrats didn't reply to a request for comment. Governor Wolf's administration declined to weigh in, but said it would continue advocating for additional state spending on schools. State Senator Vincent Hughes, the highest-ranking African-American lawmaker in the Capitol, said leaders need to take Powers' findings seriously.
They can deny the race reality of this, but the race reality is, in fact, a reality. For folks who ignore that, they're just putting their head in the sand.
James Paul also agrees with Powers' premise, but says political realities can't be ignored. He's the senior policy analyst at the Commonwealth Foundation, a fiscally conservative Harrisburg think tank.
Ultimately, the bottom line is that everyone would be better off if funding was student-based, and that means making better use of the new formula. But I also recognize that there are a lot of lawmakers who represent declining population districts, and it's going to be a heavy lift to make.
Sharif Elmeki, a principal of a predominantly black charter school in Philadelphia, says political difficulty should not be an excuse.
A lot of mouthpieces that talk about their commitment to marginalized communities, their commitment to underserved populations, but time and time again, when it's time to do something about it, people shrink.
It's also important to note that districts most concentrated with students of color have often received special funding allocations that are not included in studies of the state's main pot of education cash. So, for instance, Erie received an extra $4 million this year, and Chester Upland got an extra $12 million. These, though, are one-time infusions that are dwarfed by the amount the formula says the districts need. That's why Erie Superintendent Jay Baddams agrees with the report and continues to beat the drum for change.
If people who are actually making policy don't want to listen to it, I guess that's certainly their prerogative, but I think people in the public, they'll take note. And then it's up to them and those of us who are aware of this and realize that it needs to be corrected to do something about it.
State lawmakers return to session in mid-September. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Still ahead this evening, the conflict between real estate developers and historic preservationists heats up again in Center City, Philadelphia.
About a sense of place being lost all over the city.
We'll review the latest battleground between the old and the new as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. For the first time, the FDA is giving clearance to a concussion monitoring medical device. From the Innovations Desk, WHYY's Todd Bookman reports on the Pennsylvania company behind the Impact screening tool.
The Impact software doesn't diagnose concussions. Instead, the series of computer-based tests monitors cognitive function, helping doctors assess the symptoms of a head injury. The company contracts with schools and athletic teams, doing baseline tests on skills such as word memory and reaction time. That information is then compared with test results after a suspected concussion. Impact CEO Michael Walster says having the FDA label the device as safe and effective is a huge step for the company.
In a way, it is validation that all of the research we had been a subject of or had conducted on our own, you know, backs up the claims we've made about the product over the years.
The company was also green-lighted for separate software to test children as young as five. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
The current building boom in Center City is a real Philadelphia success story. The skyline is moving ever upward with new commercial development, and the neighborhood is enjoying a steady growth in its residential population. Though in the rush to build the new, sometimes the old gets in the way. Developers want a clean slate. Preservationists and longtime denizens voice their concern that the city's history is being compromised. That's the scenario shaping up on Jewelers Row, the area centered around Sansom Street between 7th and 8th Streets in Center City. Plan Philly's Jim Saxa has been following the events there, and he joins us now. Jim, take us to Jewelers Row.
So the developer Toll Brothers has purchased a number of buildings on the 700 block at Sansom, which is the beating heart of Jewelers Row. They're proposing to demolish those buildings and replace them with a 16-story luxury condominium, about 80 units. They're promising to put on the first floor jewelry stores, but that is not appeasing the historic preservationists.
Jim, when we consider historic preservation, what tends to come to mind are the colonial and federal era structures like Alfred Sally and Independence Hall. Put the significance of Jewelers Row in context.
If you ask preservationists, they'll say it's an iconic part of the city. I spoke with Paul Stanky, who's the executive director of the Preservation Alliance of Greater Philadelphia. And he says Jewelers Row, it's kind of like a time capsule for pre-war Philadelphia.
It's the oldest diamond district in the United States. It's the second largest after the one in New York. Its physical form as a collection of small independent businesses housed in pre-World War II small intimate scale shops and storefronts makes it unique in Center City and frankly unique across the United States.
Though to what extent is it still a viable marketplace?
Well, all of these buildings that are facing demolition, they're still occupied. People still buy jewelry in person. They don't go online for it. They might look online, but they buy in person. And the city estimates that Jewelers Row, if you count all the artisans and watchmakers and the rest, employs over 1,000 people.
Is this a fait accompli?
Probably. Toll Brothers is proposing a buy right development. That means they do not need to seek any sort of variance from the city to do the development. None of the buildings that they're going to demolish are protected on the local historic register, which means they can just bulldoze them whenever they want, essentially. Now, they do have to go through a little bit more review, but that's just delaying the inevitable. Because they're not on the historic register, that's the sort of thing that really gets these preservationists mad. Preservationists like Oscar Beisert. Beisert's sort of an all-star in Philadelphia when it comes to historic preservation. He's done 50 nominations in the last 2 years alone. And he blames the Jewelers Row situation on the city's historic commission.
The commission has to face the fact that they haven't been doing their job. They're going to have to, like, wake up. Or, you know, a lot of the fabric of Philadelphia is going to be lost during their time in office.
Beisert says only 2 to 3% of Philadelphia's buildings are historically protected. In Manhattan, that number is closer to 20. In Baltimore, it's a full third. When Philadelphia's population was shrinking, none of this was really a big problem. But today, things are booming. And for preservations like Beisert, they say the city risks losing its identity.
It's about a sense of place being lost all over the city, and there being no mechanism to make that stop. I mean, the two can coexist, development and preserving the identity of the city. That's the main thing that I think this is bringing out.
Jim, you noted earlier that the timetable can be stalled but not stopped. What is the inexorable timetable on this project?
The project has to go through what's called civic design review. Another committee will look at it, but they can only make recommendations. They're non-binding. What the preservationists are hoping is that the outcry and a petition that they have out there will convince Toll Brothers to sort of voluntarily create a design or a compromise that'll work. They could still have their tower, but maybe preserve the facades. But that, you know, Toll Brothers hasn't said whether they'd be willing to do that yet. But really, there's nothing that can truly be done to stop them if they decide to destroy these buildings.
Jim, thanks for shedding light.
Thank you.
Plan Philly's Jim Saxa on WHYY. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with additional production today from Ty Johnson. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Delaware holds its GOP primary September 13th, with two candidates vying to become the first Republican governor in nearly three decades. We'll meet one of the contenders on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.